Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name's Steve Lopez, and I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here. Glad to be sober. I want to thank the committee for inviting myself and my wife to do this. And we were chatting over a quiet bowl of deer antler soup at lunch about how we wished we had structured our commitments this weekend to be with you the entire time, and just the dice just didn't roll that way. But if we're able to come back some other time, we certainly would like to take in the whole experience, because that indeed, in my experience, is the only thing that is cachet in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is your sober experience and your willingness to share that with us. And we don't want to miss a minute of that. Thank Craig for his hospitality, and Tom, and just everybody that's associated with this. And as was mentioned earlier today, when something runs smoothly, you know that a lot of work went on behind the scenes. There's a Zen saying, the bigger the front, the bigger the back. So it's really the work that's been going on for months and months here really plays out in front of us, and it looks effortless. But being involved with some conventions myself, I know that there's a lot of work. Let's see. My sponsor has told me that there's only a couple, three things that are of any importance that you need to know about me. One is that I have a sobriety date, and that's January 21st, 1985. My home group's the Pacific Group, and I'm sponsored by a guy named Clancy. And I'm actively sponsored. And for me, I don't know, this is just descriptive, it's not prescriptive, but for a guy like me, I need to seek direction, not just follow it. Now, my time in sobriety hasn't always been that way. In fact, there are stretches of my sober life that sound worse than most people's drunkalogs, and I'll get to that in a little bit. However, that shouldn't be surprising to anyone, because I suffer from a disease. I suffer from an alcoholic illness, and when it's untreated, I behave drunk while not drinking. Basically, I behave drunk while not drinking. See, what I've come to know at my own hands and through my own stupidity, and Bill is real liberal with the use of that word in the steps, stupidity, and I understand why. I understand that my disease, my illness, my spiritual malady will take my life with or without the substance alcohol in my body, and I'll tell you that because I got very, very close, and I'll get to that in a little bit. My job here today is... I just want to say one thing about being actively sponsored. When I'm not actively sponsored, it's not a vision for you. When I'm not actively sponsored, meaning I just treat it come see, come saw, if I even acknowledge the relationship at all, I treat Alcoholics Anonymous like a filling station. I come late, I leave early, I talk during the meeting because I'm about the smartest guy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I have to say is more important than whatever could possibly be said from the podium. I don't put out my hand to newcomers. I don't take a commitment. I basically treat it like a gas station. I come and get mine, and I'm out of here, right? And that is because fools like me don't understand the power of the disease. And if I don't understand the power of this disease, then why do I need your solution? So if I trivialize the power of alcoholism, then I'm free to roll my own. I'm free to do exactly what I'm going to describe for you shortly when I get past the drinking period in my life, and I'll do that as quickly as I can because I don't need to teach anybody here how to drink. You all know how. I'm sure they didn't squirt it at you through the keyhole. So, you know, my job here today is not to entertain you, and that's good because I'm not a funny guy. Good, you know, gun to the head, I couldn't tell a joke to save my life. So my job here, particularly if you're new, I'll just share with you that I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened to me. I can't say what happened to you because I don't know. But I can tell you what I'm attempting to be like today. And I don't know who an alcoholic is and who an alcoholic isn't. By that I mean the book... In the doctor's opinion, it describes alcoholics of my type. That phrase rings true for me. I don't know who else that rings true for. But I take a drink and it triggers something that the doc describes as the phenomenon of craving. That's one feature of my disease, and it's only one feature of my disease. What's even trickier is there's a part in the book that describes sort of the advanced version of that for folks like me when I get to a late stage, or maybe not even, where it says there are times when I have no mental defense against the first drink, which means I don't have the substance in me before the craving has been triggered. That's pretty fancy. Cunning, baffling, powerful. It's a very unusual disease. It's a spectacular disease, and there's a spectacular solution for it. The problem for a guy like me is I'm too selfish to save my own goddamn life. That's the problem. And if there's such a thing as a genetic code for an alcoholic, mine is on page 62. Starts with selfishness, self-centeredness. See, I'd like to blame everything in my life on my drinking, my alcoholism, my alcoholic nature, and I can't get away with it. Now, the grand paradox for all folks who are new is this. I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable, and yet I'm responsible for everything I've ever done. I can't control the stuff that I did while I was drinking, but I'm responsible for cleaning it up. And I have to get friendly with those, you know, if that equation stays imbalanced, I'm going to leave because I'm going to be uncomfortable. I'm not going to understand what my responsibilities are. I'm not going to be able to live with a solution without understanding the solution. See, it doesn't matter whether I like or enjoy what you tell me to do. It doesn't matter whether I even understand the black parts of the book. It has come to me full force that the doing of it, you know, it's either this. It's either pick up the book, pick up a mop, pick up a newcomer, or I'm going to pick up a drink. And around West LA, they say, if you want to walk on water, pick up a mop. That's how we do it. You know, get busy, do something. I got sober in the East, and my first sponsor used to say, back in those smoking meetings that my wife alluded to, you know, if you want to find some sobriety, pick up an ashtray. There's sobriety underneath every one of those. And all he was talking about was the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles called El Monte, which was very much like my wife, my first resentment. Roller derby was high art in our town. The cultural mecca was a joint called the El Monte Legion Stadium. We'd get the overflow wrestling card from the Olympic. We'd get, you know, Cal's Corral, Spade Cooley. The piece de resistance was New Year's Eve. There's a guy named Johnny Otis who was this DJ. And, you know, he'd utter those immortal words, no Levi's or Capri's, please. So, you know, El Monte was kind of like this place that it's kind of like this. I didn't grow up as a stranger around drinking, and the whole town seemed to be across, you know, on the other, the wrong side of the tracks. And, drinking was a big part of my family's life, not just partying, but it seemed like it took on sort of an extra special, you know, there was just a little extra buzz in the air when they were partying. And I can remember, you know, thinking, you know, I'm 6 or 7 years old and I'm looking out the back window and I'm watching these people and they're taking pulls off these long necks and they're knocking back these tequila shooters. And I don't know where I've got these ideas. I've got voices in my head to this day I still haven't been introduced to. And I'm thinking, who are these people? I haven't had a drink yet. I'm just like, who are these people? You know, I'm for sure that my little identity bracelet has been switched to the hospital, that I really belong to some other family, that, you know, that, see, I don't know if any of you have done much partying with Mexicans. As a kid, I didn't have much of a choice. And you know what? If you're Hispanic, don't come up and give me attitude after the talk. That was then. This is now. My favorite band is Los Lobos. I go to Olvera Street as often as possible, eat as much Mexican food as I can get my hands on. But that was then. This is now. And what that's about, it's not about geography. It's not about ethnicity. It's about the here and the now. It's about I was my own unwanted reality, and everything around me was a part of that. And I just couldn't deal with the then and there. You know what I'm saying? So I'm looking out the back window, and it's sort of like the promises. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, they will sing if they drink enough. You know what I mean? And I'm listening to them sing these Mexican folk songs, and I'm thinking, geez, where are my people? I am for certain that there is a rogue wasp in my background that if he just would step forward and declare himself, you know, I could be saved and be, you know, shuttled away to Boston or someplace. You know, that there's some guy in my background, an ancestor named Wellington Mumford Chubb III, as opposed to my actual grandfathers, Alfonso Flores and Juan Lopez, but there you have it, you know. So those are the notions, and that's part of the setup, because by the time I get to high school, I'm just like the guy that's described on page 73. It says, more than most people, alcoholics of my type like to lead a double life. And I'm already there, man. You know, I am capable of auditioning for and penetrating any group I want. That's not a skill, that's a liability, because I don't know what to do once I get there. It took me many years into sobriety to understand that I didn't understand how to be a worker among workers, how to be a friend among friends, how to be a family member. I didn't know any of that stuff. Others, that word, wasn't in my vocabulary. I'm just trying to get over. I'm just trying to get over on you. That's all that's going on there. You know, and so, you know, in high school, I'm just like, I'm with the jocks, and I'm with the car club guys, and I'm with this guy and that group, and I'm with the Scholar Society folks while I still had a couple of brain cells that communicated. And, you know, I'm just doing all this stuff. But in junior, senior year, that summer, I meet my people. I meet you. I meet the drinkers and the dancers and the jive asses and the guys that are dropping out of school and the guys that are going AWOL from the Navy. And I hadn't been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't read the big book. I hadn't been introduced to a sponsor. I didn't know anything about the steps. I'm not smart enough to understand alcoholism on my own, and I didn't see what happened that summer. I thought the magic was that I just found the right people to hang out with, but what I missed was the common thread of every experience of conviviality was this social lubricant called alcohol. And it was indeed, in my case as well, a power greater than myself, and I didn't know what I was dealing with. I just thought that I was having a good time, and I had finally found the right folks to hang out with. And I graduated from high school in the mid-60s, and you know, the Sunset Strip was on, and you know, all of that stuff. And what to say about all of that? I guess the first thing to say, just as kind of a segue, is I used enough drugs to kill a Shetland pony, but I'm not a drug addict. I'm not a drug addict any more than our co-founders were. They sedated and they probably stimulated. I mean, get real. Bob had access. I was in the medical business for 30 years, and every physician and surgeon that I knew had unlimited access. So access was not a problem there for that guy. The issue is identification. So I'm an alcoholic who happens to be a pig. You know what I mean? I mean, if we're drinking and you say, hey, well, have you tried smoking these old gym socks? I'm going to go, yeah, but just pass the bottle. Or whatever it is that we're doing is fine. See, I've done all these different things, these other substances. And the issue for me is it's not that we don't talk about drugs and Alcoholics Anonymous. It's that it's pointless. Just like Dr. Bob said. What Dr. Bob said is this, on page 180 of the third edition of our book, referring to Bill, he said, that guy described my disease from his experience. He described the magnificent power of identification, and that, to my way of thinking, is why it says in the foreword to the first edition, we were over 100 men and women, and essentially, I'm going to paraphrase, our job here is to tell you precisely how we got sober. And why is precision necessary? Because an idiot like me will find any excuse to back his way out of the room and go out there and die again. Not only will I take my own life, I will withdraw the power that God has given me to help others in this room. It's the ultimate act of selfishness. It is the ultimate act of selfishness. I've been given a second opportunity, which is the whole purpose of crossing that spiritual frontier from 1 to 12. See, there's a little pit stop there right around the seventh step, just in case I'm thinking I'm doing so good because I did my inventory and I even got on my knees with the old man and said, you know, I've made a list of the things that I'd like to get rid of, and if you want to take them, take them. And now I'm really thinking, oh, Steve, is there no end to thy goodness? And there's a little reminder in there that says, hey, this is not a self-help program. This is not about you getting your life together. The reason you've been given this opportunity, Steve, is to be of service. Foreign to your nature as that may be, it's to be of service, to be of maximum use to God and your fellows, right? It's just pointing the way down to the 12th step, which I ain't at yet at 6 and 7. I got a lot of stuff yet ahead of me, right? Well, I am clear on one thing today. I've had way too much caffeine before I got up here. Started my day at 5 o'clock to get, I'd speak last night in L.A., so I couldn't come earlier. And, yeah, well, okay. So now that we've kind of given that up, I'll slow down. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that this whole issue of identification is really where the power is, and the power comes out of the book. The book, it's there. It's Bill said it on page 15, that it's a design for living that works well in rough going. That's the whole point. It isn't that I get what I want. It isn't that I get the Benz and the Bucks, and I got the blonde, but the Benz and the Bucks haven't come yet. Maybe in the next 21 years. It isn't that I get what I want. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous for me is that I don't drink when I don't get dessert first. When I'm sitting around thinking that you've got the bigger ice cream cone, when I'm up to my neck in my character defects, and I haven't taken a drink because somehow my fingers are trained enough to call my sponsor or my feet are trained enough to go to a meeting, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is I'm doing something completely foreign to my nature because I'm too selfish to save my own life. It's just much easier for me to succumb to what it says on page 62, all of that self-absorptive behavior. That's my nature. That conspires with my character defects and my alcoholism, and before I know it, I'm going to be finding a drink. Or if I go too long without a drink, I'm going to need to find a gun. It's one or the other. And I'll say a little bit more about that because the voices come back. The clattering hooves are there. The four horsemen are back. It's a reality. This is a very, very powerful disease. So I started drinking in high school. Yeah, let's get back to that. Did a bunch of drugs. I mentioned that. The deal is this. The short form of the third tradition allows idiots like me in the door, right? Because I don't know what an alcoholic is. So it says, I just need to have a desire to stop drinking. So I get to sit in your midst, thank God. I don't need, you know, you don't give me a pop quiz. You don't screen me. This isn't a degree-granting institution. I don't need to know anything. I just need to say I need to stop drinking because my life's killing me and I don't understand it. And I'm drinking because I can't stand what I see in the mirror anymore. I'm long since past not being able to stand you. That's way over. I can't stand me. And I can't even articulate that. I don't even know what's killing me, man. I'm looking at those bloodshot eyes one more time, you know. And so it allows me in the door, but I am thoroughly convinced to my innermost self that the only way I can stay coming back through the door is if I fully embrace the long form of that third tradition, which talks about the disease of alcoholism. If you're new here, this is going to flip you out. It did when I heard it. I don't have a drinking problem. I suffer from alcoholic illness. I was reading it this morning on page 20 and 21 of our book where it talks about the hard drinker. And it says, given sufficient motivation, that person, a nudge from the judge, a nudge from whoever, the employer, the new fiancé, whatever the external motivation is, that person has the capability. It doesn't say that they're guaranteed to stop. But they have the capability of stopping, and here's what I'm missing, and not starting again if they don't want to. I might be able to put the brakes on for whatever reason. But see, it took me almost 17 years into sobriety. I'm mostly in the sometimes slowly category to understand what my sponsor says over and over again, his simple description of alcoholism. Clancy does the most elegant and economical description of this disease I've ever heard. I'm having trouble drinking. I'm having trouble staying sober. There ain't no friendly direction, and I can't mediate the effects of this thing on my own. I'm powerless over alcohol, and I'm powerless over sobriety. See, if I had control on either side of the equation, why would I be here? If I could drink as long as I wanted to drink and control that, why would I need to come to Alcoholics Anonymous? Or if I could stay sober as long as I wanted to and pick up a drink when I want or not, why would I come to Alcoholics Anonymous? But that equation's out of whack for me, and I don't even understand how it's out of whack. I just know that it is. I just know that if I do pick up a drink, it starts a craving that, you know, if you say, Steve, today someone will say to me, you want a drink? And I'll go, no, I got to be to work next Tuesday. I mean, and I'm not kidding. I mean, it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't say that, you know, to be entertaining. I just like, I don't know what's going to happen, man. You know, just like I didn't back then, only I wasn't smart enough to understand what goes on with this disease. And I'm ripping and running up and down, you know, the Sunset Strip. And I do what, if you're new here, you'll hear the phrase geographic. And I didn't take a geographic, but I did something that had the same about-face effect on my life. I got married at age 19. Drunk or sober, I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. I should have been chained to the mast, and I'll tell you why. Not that there's anything wrong with the institution of marriage, you know. I mean, I'll tell you the three least favorite chapters for this alcoholic, and maybe you can identify with this in the big book, are to the wives, family afterwards, and to the employers. I don't want to read about the way I treated those institutions of living when I was out there drinking and how I ignored them well into sobriety because, hey, I'm sober in AA. I'm doing the steps. I'm getting all my outside stuff together. I got mine, which is why it's so dangerous for me to stop with just the steps and not take the traditions into my life in the same way. I can stop at the 12th step with this I've got mine attitude. I've got it together. I've made my amends. I'm something in AA or whatever the case is, you know, and not understand that it's not in my nature to play well with others. It's just not in my nature to play well. It's not going to be some sort of 60s love-in just because I've done the steps, you know. And Bill knew that. You know, I'm going to get way ahead of myself here. But if the traditions were not necessary, Bill would have gotten on his horse like Paul Revere and run around and said, please recommit to the steps. But he didn't. He understood that we needed a larger spiritual principled-based footprint upon which to walk as a fellowship, not as individuals. The steps do that for me just fine. I can walk literally in those steps as an individual, but if we're going to march together, it appears, and it appeared to Bill, that we needed something larger. And I'll get back to that in a second as to how it relates in my life or what I attempt to do with it. You know, however haltingly, awkwardly, and poorly I apply them, I know they're there and I know they're for me. It's not just something that's talked about at a business meeting once every 3 months. And I'll tell you why. Because in a state of dry drunkenness, if I'm here doing whatever it is that I want to do to me, if I question God's will, if you're new here, I'm going to give you a little secret. It took me a long time to get it. I don't ever wonder what God's will is. I don't ever wonder what it is, and I'll tell you why. Because, first of all, I just need to take out my 4-step inventory, and that tells me what I do to me when I'm attempting to run it. And then I take out my A-step list, and I know what I do to you when I'm attempting to run it. And everything outside of those two documents, by extension, is God's will. Because it ain't my idea of a good time. Those two documents are what I want to do when I'm doing it to me and when I'm doing it to you, regardless. So everything else is on to the next event. Do what's in front of you. Practice those principles. Apply, you know, apply. We stayed married for 15 years. I can't believe this. I'm just like in and out of all this stuff, and I guess that's what's supposed to happen today. So you're in charge. We stayed married for 15 years and, you know, from age 19 to 34. And, my only suspicion is that we both had jobs. And that was that I was obsessed with taking drinks and she was obsessed with counting them. So, you know, we had this sort of dynamic together. And along the way, I'd like to tell you all about that marriage, but I can't, and I can't because I wasn't there. At the end of that 15 years, if you'd put a gun to my head, I couldn't have told you what that woman's favorite flower was, her favorite fragrance, her favorite food, her favorite music, because I just didn't care. So I'm like a shark. If you cross my path and I need to exercise my gums, I'll tell you what makes my way of relating to people when I'm an active alcoholic or when I am suffering from untreated alcoholism so disgusting is I don't even hate you enough to care. I just do you and keep on going because you're in my way, you know? And if you're stupid enough to hook up with me and stay hooked up, that's your problem. Because I got to get done what I got to get done. And I'll tell you, I shared this last night. You know, one of the very telling experiences in that marriage, I can remember I experienced a certain amount of success. I'd been in the medical business for a long time and had experienced some promotions and moved to the East. And one night we were out with some other couples and we were at the Barbizon Plaza in Manhattan. It was a nice place, kind of upscale. And we're drinking and, you know, just like at the Mayflower Hotel, you know, the gay crowd inside, the conviviality, the clinking drinks, the whole deal. And I like that. I like that. You know, that's me. I so identify with Bill Wilson, you know, where he talks about, I'm a part of life at last. I mean, I can remember that experience when I got my first promotion when we moved to the East Coast and I got invited to this party on Beacon Hill, right? And, this doctor, he's a world famous surgeon and, he lives in his penthouse on the third floor and the fourth floor is Ethel Kennedy, their Secret Service man. I mean, there's some rich folks in this building and, this guy is, you know, his guest list is the who's who of orthopedic surgery and orthopedic research. They're MDs and PhDs and I'm just a jiving salesman. The only initials I have after my name are IOU. So I'm there. And there's tinkling martinis and Harvard is across the Charles River and there's this $1 million Scrimshaw collection and I'm amongst all of these fancy folks and I hear the voice. I hear Bill's voice and the voice says, you made it. His voice said, I'm a part of life at last. My voice said, you've made it. You're just a kid from El Monte, for Christ's sake, and here you are. You know, you barely got out of high school with a scorching D average, and here you are with all of these fancy folks. And any alcoholic of my type knows that that voice lasted about 10 seconds before the next voice said, and what'd you dream the next night? How long is it going to be before they, if they discover that you're a fake and a sham and an imposter, but when? And what are you going to do about that? And I don't know, is it bad to get tight at a party, a business party? I don't know, but I can tell you that the next morning at that particular situation, I'm invited to go into surgery at the Harvard Medical School, which is a rare privilege for a layperson. I'm going in with a chaired professor. I'm going to watch surgery. I'm going to gown up. I'm going to stand at his elbow. I've done it thousands of times, but this is a rare privilege because this guy is very, very famous and has this particular technique that's really neat to watch, and I'm going to get tutored. And I show up, but I'm in the doctor's lounge on all fours, and I'm heaving up my socks, and I'm just vomiting, you know, in front of anybody, orderlies, nurses, doctors going by, and I'll tell you why that is. The book says that guys like me, or four guys like me, that my alcoholic life is the only one that seems normal. See, I don't know that you didn't do that either before you came to work. I don't know that y'all didn't vomit and then come to work. So, I mean, I just do that, and I still have the bounce back. I'm still looking good on the outside. I still have it going on. I'm still a legend in my own mind. And so I'm married to this woman, and we go through this experience, of trudging the happy road. And like I said, we were in this get together at this swanky restaurant, and I didn't know I was a blackout drinker until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're in a group of people, and we're not getting served as fast as I like us to. And I don't know about you, but I don't get mad. I get into action. So I get to the bar, and I'm gonna get a tray of drinks, and I'm gonna bring them back. You know, I'm gonna get this big tray of drinks, and I'm gonna bring them back. Well, that's my intent. About an hour passes, and there's a tug on my sleeve, and apparently I'm in a blackout, and I'm talking to this woman like, you know, we're old friends, and I mean, I have no idea what I said to her, and the tug on my sleeve is my wife. And let me tell you just how much concern I had for how she felt about what I was doing. Zero. The only concern I had was that I got caught doing whatever it was that I was doing. That's the only concern that I have when I'm drinking. I'm not immoral. I'm amoral. I just don't have any feelings about what's going on with you, you know, unless it suits me to get something from you. So those were the kinds of experiences that we had, and I didn't know anything about this relationship when I left it, because I didn't know anything about relationships in general. We were having a conversation earlier today. I'm not one of those guys. What I know about my marriage today is I'm not one of those guys that can do a 50-50 relationship. They don't work for me because I keep track. I'm wondering if you're putting in your 50%. I can't do that. I can't do that. The only way that it works for me, and I can't do this either, but I have to attempt to do this, is to be 100% committed to my spouse's well-being. And the only way that I can do that is to take the marching orders that are articulated very specifically in that 11-step prayer, where it says, Steve, your job today is to comfort. Steve, your job today is to understand rather than to be understood. It's to love and not seek to be loved. It's to forgive instead of seek. And you know what? I do a terrible job of that. I heard a speaker a couple of weeks ago, and she said one of her goals on a daily basis is to let five people be wrong. I thought, that's interesting. I tried it last week. I think I let one person be wrong the whole week. You know what I mean? But it's progress, I suppose. The more I drank, the more successful I became. I've heard some of you say this in your experiences, and I didn't understand it because I didn't know what I was dealing with. And I had this company that I was a part of. I was a vice president at 31, and we were a Cinderella story, and I was making more money than God, and people were saying I was bulletproof, and I was believing them. And I'd love to get up on the high wire and go and negotiate deals, and I'd do it, and I started becoming more and more enamored with the idea of just drinking all the time. There was no separation between my social life and my professional life, and I would show up to the horror of my distributors and go in. My specialty was academic medicine, and going in and talking to the chiefs of these departments and these chairmen and just pulling it off with, you know, just my just blatant arrogance. Because I could speak their language, and it was just a gift. And I remember when I started falling off the high wire and I didn't notice it. And I can remember the night that I flew out to Northwestern University to meet the chairman of the department there. And the person that I picked me up, that picked me up at the airport was somebody I had partied with. There's a guy in my home group named Lonnie who talks about, you know, living in a vacant lot and even the bums wanted him to leave. It's like when your lower companions are, you know, they're really like upset with your presence. It's time to leave. And if you miss that, you've slept through the movie. And I didn't get that. You know, I mean, this woman was horrified and we go and we see this prominent surgeon and we don't get it. We don't get the business. I don't have my self-respect. I don't have her respect. I'm missing it. That's, you know, it's just like the beginning of the end and I can't see it. And that's basically what happened to me, you know, with that relationship. When it was time to leave that relationship, I thought I was just claustrophobic. I thought that, you know, I needed some other thing on the outside of me. I mean, I didn't have the language skills to articulate that, but what was going on is that my disease one more time was a ventriloquist and it had needed more elbow room and that's all that was going on there. And it turned left and I didn't see it do that. You know what I'm saying? And so when I left that marriage of 15 years, I drank for another 3 years before I got to what is today my last drink. And, I went from living in this idyllic situation to living like an absolute animal. I guess that's the simplest way to put it. And I got shamed into coming to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't looking for you guys. I didn't know what you guys were. I thought, you know, Easy Does It was an Amway slogan. I had no idea, you know, what any of this was about. I shook for a couple of weeks. I probably should have been hospitalized, but I just didn't know anything about this stuff. I didn't know what I didn't know. And so I got to my first meeting after about 5 weeks of being dry and crazy. A non-alcoholic friend of mine slipped a copy of a new pair of glasses under my arm, and that saved my life. I didn't know what I was reading. I just read it, and for some reason it spoke to me without me understanding it on any kind of an intellectual level, and I suppose that's the way the message comes in best, when this false intellect of mine, this arrogance, this elitism isn't in the way, when humility, you know, has an just a bare opportunity, just a glimpse, the truth can come in. And that's how it was the night of what is today my last drink. I'm standing in a cemetery across from where I lived. I lived across from the Ridgewood Cemetery in Ridgewood, New Jersey. And I'm saying I'm regaling my ex-wife, which she came over because I had called her and was yelling at her about something, I don't know, alimony or some such thing. She said, you know, you sound suicidal. And I had been for months and didn't know it. So we're taking a walk in the cemetery, and she says, after I'm just going on and on and on, blah, 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 about them or her or whoever, she says, I think it's your drinking. And people have been saying that for 2 or 3 years, you know. And what happened was this. You couldn't have stabbed me more profoundly if you'd stuck a knife in my gut. I'd long since been out of the truth about my life. I was out of lies, and I couldn't dance, and I couldn't defend against the truth, and it stuck me. I was arrested. I stopped. And it was like my life was whirling around at 180,000 miles an hour, and I didn't understand what that was about. And I just said, you know, apropos to where we were standing, I could just lay down here and not get up again because I'm real tired. So I found my way to you guys because I was embarrassed into coming to AA, and, you know, I came back, and I would like to tell you that I really took to this program wholeheartedly and with an abundance of sincerity, but the problem is that I'm slick, I'm a con, I'm a sober horse thief, and I listen to the lingo, and my agenda is real clear, only I hadn't admitted it to you, my sponsor, or myself, and that is that if you give me back my money, property, and prestige, what unmanageability. I just need to get that W-2 pumped up. I need another fancy business card. I need the right woman on my arm. I need to drive the right car. I need to get all the outside stuff, because it was the outside stuff that made it work. That's what I accumulated as a result of doing what I was doing successfully in that business. And to me, that was what I was supposed to, you know, that was my destiny. That was what was owed to me. You know, I don't know about you, but for 21 years, I've been looking in that book for the 12 entitlements, and they're not there. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't owe me a goddamn thing. not only are they not there, thank goodness, the 12 opinions are not there. The 12 judgments are not there. The 12 criticisms are not there. Why? Because they're a waste of time. When I engage in that stuff, and I do, I admit to trafficking in personalities as much as the next person might. I do nothing to enhance my sobriety or yours, and I'm wasting AA's time. And there goes the second tradition in my life, because the minute I form an opinion about how you should be leading yours, I'm assuming the role of an ultimate authority. And that ain't my place. And it ain't yours either. So, I get here and, you know, I've never met a microphone I didn't like, and I've taught public speaking, and I've done a lot of it, and I ended up at 7 months because my cousin preceded me into the program, and he's in Manhattan, and he's sober, and I end up speaking at the largest speaker meeting in Manhattan at 7 months of sobriety. And my wife used this phrase this morning, and this is exactly what I did. You know, I shared my insight, strength, and hope with those good people, because that's all I had. I didn't have any sober experience. Now, you can't turn down an AA request. But I caution you, it's not a favor to the individual and it's not a favor to the fellowship to bring somebody to the podium with very little time. It's dangerous. My first sponsor said to me, Steve, if you keep doing that, if you do enough of that and you keep reading your own press clippings, you're going to think you're somebody in AA, you're going to think you're healed, you're going to think you've gotten past this thing, and possibly you'll drink. And he was right. At 3 years, I graduated, right? I had done your stupid steps, I had done the panels, I had been sponsored, I had done inventories, I had made amends, I was sponsoring guys, I was speaking in AA, right? I'm somebody. And I'm listening to you guys whine in meetings about finances and romances, and I'm thinking, I'm just about the smartest guy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not going to go through the same drudgery that you idiots go through. I'm going to get my stuff all packed in one bag. So I started off on what some of my friends call Steve's not-so-excellent adventure in sobriety. I didn't drink, but I have no idea how much time was left on the meter. The same with resentments. See, it's very cavalier of me to carry a resentment, because when I come out of it, I don't know how much time was left on the meter. I don't know if tomorrow, if I resent you today, I don't know if it's tomorrow that something so provocative, so activating, or even so trivial will trigger the drink. The book's either true or it's not, and it says, without help, it's too much for us. And it's taken me almost 21 years to understand that it is me. I'm the it. I'm powerless over my own alcoholic nature and the illness which resides within me. And yet the paradox is I can't use that as an excuse for bad behavior, because I'm also responsible for the wreckage that I create. So I go off and I do some of the stuff. I don't have time to go through the list. My wife articulated a portion of it, but I'm, you know, I'm oming, I'm rolfing, I'm chanting. Yes, the deer antlers. It's a Chinese herb. Acupuncture. I'm studying three forms of martial arts. I'm studying tea ceremony with a lineage trained master. I'm just getting it on. I'm doing primal scream. I'm doing highly confrontational group therapy. And I'm not here to there's a 10th tradition. I'm not here to be controversial. I'm not here to talk about therapy. It probably works for my non-alcoholic neighbor. The problem is, and I'm an informed opinion, I'm an informed consumer in sobriety. I spent, a decade on the couch. And I didn't have to. And I'll tell you why in a second. It's in the fourth step. For a guy like me, it's in the fourth step. But all therapy that I'm acquainted with, and you may be acquainted with different kinds, and that's okay, God bless you, but all therapy that I'm acquainted with is organized around one principle and one principle only, and that is empowerment. And this here book, this book, says that my ego must be smashed on a daily basis. So it's got my ego going in the wrong direction. So for my non-alcoholic neighbor, it's probably fine. But for me, it's the kiss of death. And it took me right back to the gates of insanity, because now I'm my own higher power. Man, I'm getting it all figured out, as though figuring it out. Figuring it out, being analytical, is not one of the steps. There's nothing in there about analysis of any sort. It asks me to get stupid long enough to follow some direction. Get stupid long enough to understand what I'm dealing with here, which is an impossible situation. that I can't, I'm on, you know, the night of my last drink, I'm on page 152, I'm on the horns of a dilemma. I can't imagine life with alcohol, I can't imagine life without it. The book is true in my case. I'm hearing voices in my head as loud as the one coming out of it right now. I'm outside in a snowdrift. It's November, it's New Jersey, the wind's whipping. I'm the only fool that's outside and I've got a flask in my coat. And the reason that I'm outside is because I can't stay inside and drink the way I want to drink because I'm in a play. They're not even serving booze in there and I got to have a drink. And I got a voice going on. And that voice is saying, you just got to hold some of this down. If you can just get some, you got to get some of this in you or you're going to die. And if you can, you'll be okay. And there's another voice that says, yeah, but if you take one more drop of this in your body, it'll kill you. Well, now I've got two voices. Alcohol's always been the solution. And now I've got this debate going on and no referee. And I don't know what to do, man. I don't know what to do. I'm not smart enough to understand what's happening. I just don't understand alcoholism. I don't even know that that's what it is that I'm dealing with, you know. So page 152 came, you know, it came full force in my life on the night of my last drink. And, but I don't understand that. You know, 90 days later, I'm like, I'm fine. I just need a new job or I just need, you know, I'm 90 days into sobriety. I need a new job. I forget the night before my last drink where I was. I forget that night in the cemetery where I just am completely despondent and all out of hope. I forget these things because as my former sponsor Glenn Loyster said, the ego has remarkable recuperative powers. And mine certainly does. And so I'm thinking I just need to get the outside fixed and I'm doing all of this stuff. And the problem is that, see, my as I alluded to earlier, that my life is sometimes looks worse than most people's drunkologues is because I don't have a drinking problem. I'm still suffering from the same disease. It's just I don't have the substance alcohol in my body. I'm just behaving drunk while not drinking. So I'm trying all these outside solutions, and here's what's cunning, baffling, and powerful. Not that I did pick up a drink that I didn't, and that I'm dying in front of you one day at a time, and you don't know it, and I don't know it. And meetings are not enough. They help. They help. They're essential. There's no chapter in our book called Into Meetings. It does say that we meet frequently so newcomers can find us. But I'm not doing the work of sobriety. See, I'm not doing the work of sobriety. And why do I need to? See, if I don't understand the full implications of the problem, I don't need your solution. If I don't understand that it's more than just not consuming booze, why do I need to do any of this? But yet I'm a dead man. I'm a walking dead man. I don't understand that I can't manage my own life. I don't understand that unmanageability starts from the inside out. I don't understand any of that stuff. And what I further don't understand is I really don't understand. It took me, you know, I get lucky. At 13 years physically sober, I go to a meeting I hadn't planned to be at and I hear a guy named Glenn L. that hadn't planned to be there and I hear him share and he saved my life. That's the short version of it and I'll come back to that in a little bit. But I don't understand any of this stuff. I don't understand that in the second step, that the path of restoration is fully laid out there. That God's means of restoring me include the 12 steps, and it's in the book that way. See, when we get to page 58 and we start reading the 12 steps, we ain't to the third step yet. That happens in two more pages where it says, being convinced we're now at step 3. For me, God's process of restoration includes recognizing that this power is calling the shots. This power is going to guide me through these steps on its terms, not on my terms. And when I make this decision, you know, Clint Hodges, being an attorney, says, you know, why don't we read the fine print? And why did they include the fine print after the prayer rather than before? And the reason is pretty obvious, is because we wouldn't have read it. You know, the fine print is, you know, after we say the prayer and we make the commitment, it says, we thought well before doing this, but we are kind of backwards, right? So then we go, oops. But yeah, that makes complete sense because the preceding paragraph, which is something I ignored over and over again, the preceding paragraph says, Steve, pay attention. This relationship is highly conditional. Access is free. Maintenance is highly conditional. It's conditional in this way. It says, I'll be provided for if I stay close and do his work well. If those aren't conditions, I don't know what is. There's no handouts in sobriety. That's why those good people said, we're going to tell you precisely how we did it because your life depends on it. Do it, don't do it, but this is what we're doing. This is what it's taken for us, and half of them still died drunk. Half of them still died drunk. So I don't understand what the path of restoration is. I've just spent a decade on the couch trying to create my own, and it got me to a place, I'm back on page 152 only, I'm not dealing with alcohol, I'm dealing with alcoholism now. So I'm really baffled because I've done all your stuff and I've been to your meetings and I've had sponsors and I've been around you now for over a decade. And I want to take my life every day. And I don't understand, you know, that the perfection of the four step my wife mentioned earlier about when she finally did one with four columns. But the structure of that four step has three elements, you know, and it's perfect for a guy like me because it talks about fear, and it talks about resentment, and it talks about sex. What it's talking about is the mental, the emotional, and the instinctual. There ain't no more. There ain't no more that I gotta look at. In fact, if I spent my entire lifetime using that four step as a high intensity light, I don't have time or skill to get it all. And it's not about me navel gazing anyway. But if I need that four step, it's there, you know? If I take that fourth step and I do what it says, and it talks about meditating during the course of that fourth step, and it talks about analyzing those resentments only in terms of my responsibilities there, and it talks about turning over those instincts to God by praying for a new ideal. It talks about a lot of stuff that I've never even thought I needed to do, right? But I need to do it, apparently. And it's not because I want to be good or a poster child, it's because those are the termites that gnaw away at whatever little faltering sobriety I might try and cobble together on my own. Or I should say abstinence. Physical abstinence is all that I can put together on my own. I cannot put together sobriety on my own. I can be physically abstinent for a period of time. And I don't know how long that is. I don't know how long the fuse is. I do know the pilot light is lit. But I don't know how long the fuse is, just like I don't know how long the meter is. So I do that four step and I'm thinking I'm pretty good, and what needs to happen then is, in the spirit of disclosure, I need to give that away to a sponsor. And what's important about that is that in this smaller blue book, its treatment of the fifth step says that many of us, when we finally did an inventory and gave it away to a sponsor for the first time, felt the presence of God. Why would I pass that opportunity up? I perhaps finally felt the presence of God, and what's important about feeling the presence of God is it's batting practice for a guy like me, because as soon as I'm done with that, my sponsor is going to remand me into the custody of the old man. He's going to say, fine, Steve, go home, take the book down, look at the first five propositions, see if you're ready, because it's you and the old man, and you're going to do six and seven, and you're going to say, you know what, this is the stuff I've discovered so far that's standing between me and you and me and them, and I'm as ready as I can be under the conditions of today. And God is going to say, remember, this ain't a self-help program, and why you're on this path is to get to 12. But if you really believe that, Steve, you really believe that, make a list. Get off your knees. Make a list and go see those people. It's the same thing that Dr. Bob resisted. We're all alcoholics of my type are all the same. He resisted going to do those amends. What are they going to think? What are they going to say? They already know. It's like when I went in to see my boss, right? I had been abstinent for 30 days before I'd got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I cobbled together like 5 weeks. I went in to see Alex. I reported to the president of this company. I said, I stopped drinking. I haven't had a drink in 30 days. He said, that's good, because I was going to fire you today. I mean, that's how much it wasn't, how it wasn't a secret in my life. Everybody knew about it. You know, I had just burnt every relationship down. And that's the point, is that it's not about being a secret. It's about going out and making those amends, and it really doesn't matter. It's either the book is true or it's not. Either God is everything or he's nothing. So when it calls upon me to do those amends, or to look upon my work situation and, you know, wife or no wife, job or no job, it either means something or it doesn't, or I'm just faking it, or it's just podium flash, you know. And so that's the next step, is to make those amends. And I certainly, you know, with Glenn's help, and I've made other amends since then, since Clancy's been my sponsor. And you heard some of this morning. you know, I can make an amends over here thinking that the remedy or what's going to, the fallout from that situation is it's going to correct X, and it may correct X, but Y gets changed over here. And I didn't even know I was suffering from a problem with Y until all of a sudden I go, oh, geez, you know, that all of a sudden fear of economic insecurity has left me and I didn't even see it. And I had nothing to do with it, and that's the beauty of the promises. Or, I will admit this to probably for the first time from the podium. One of the promises I have never believed to come true for me was that I would not wish to shut the door on the past. That I would not, you know, regret it. And somehow, I've gotten to a place, not through my own doing, through your help, of being able to find my own actions regrettable in those experiences, but not regret the fact that they occurred. That may sound like double talk if you're new, but the fact is that they occurred if they occurred. I'm responsible for what I'm responsible for, and I need to be able to share them, not in my own way, but as it says in the book, around page 125, that in God's hands. In God's hands. It says, my dark past can become useful for saving lives. And so that's the point of this stuff, is that I need to cross the spiritual frontier from 1 to 12. And when I get to 12, it's not like I'm going to start channeling Bob or levitating or, you know what I mean? It just says this. Steve, when you were standing at the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, you were utterly useless. If you don't believe us, read page 52, read the bedevilments. You couldn't control your emotional nature. You couldn't hold a job. You couldn't be useful to anybody else. You're just immersed in your own little problems. My alcoholism's killing me. It's the DUI. She left. I'm in debt. Da-da. Isn't that the first step? That's what I bring in the door. It's just my baggage and my woe is me's. And I'm absolutely useless. I'm just useless to another living soul. I've got to cross the spiritual frontier and get to 12 so that in this little blue book where it says when a man or woman has a spiritual awakening, they don't begin to levitate and they don't hold seances. It just says they can now do, think, act, and feel that in a way that they couldn't before. I.e., I can become useful, and I couldn't do that on my own steam. Without help, it is too much for us. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Protection from what? I don't need protection from anybody in this room. I need protection from me. I am the host of this alcoholic illness, and it ain't ever going away. There's no time off for good behavior. There's no statute of limitations. There's no grace period. You know what I mean? It's just not going to change. And so I get to that amount of activity, and I am inclined to go, whew, glad I got that done. You know, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? And I can just as easily patently ignore the traditions. And I'll just say this very quickly before my time is up here. My approach to the unity of the first tradition is not that I love you all, because I don't. I mean, I will, here's what alcoholic love is. I mean, not on a personality level. I don't know many of you, and I'm definitely an acquired taste, I can tell you that. But what alcoholic love is time and attention, and it comes out this way in my life. You call me at, say, 3 in the morning, and you say, Steve, you are the last son of a bitch in the world I want to talk to right now. I can't stand you, but I can't reach my sponsor. I can't seem to find anybody else. And I think I'm going to drink. And if the 12th tradition is active in my life, I must say, where are you? I will come to you now. And we'll find a coffee shop. We'll sit up. We'll go to a meeting. We'll make some phone calls. We'll do whatever we need to do to get you plugged in. That's assuming that you're willing to go at any length to be helped. If you're not, our hats are off to you. Adios. Call me when you sober up. Hate to be so cold, but, you know, lifeguards have rules too, and I ain't going down with the ship. But if you haven't taken that drink and you want help, even if you hate my guts, principles must triumph personalities. Principles must triumph preferences. So the deal is this. My handshake with my expression of unity to the fellowship is that the next 11 traditions are something I'm going to surrender to against my will, because every one of them requires surrender. Trust me, man, I'd just soon speak as the ultimate authority around here, right? I'd like to make up our rules of membership. I'll discuss and describe and direct the limits of autonomy for our group. I'll tell you guys what our primary purpose is. I'll tell you what our affiliation should be. I'm glad to discuss what and to structure our fiscal policies in terms of support. You know, I want to be treated like a special worker. When I have a position in the group, I don't want to rotate out. I don't mind being controversial. I don't mind promoting. I'm a good promoter. I'm up to 11 if anybody's counting. But the deal is that sooner or later, anonymity must visit itself upon me if I'm going to stick around for any length of time. Can't live without it. Don't want it. Don't know how to do it. Can't live without it. The great paradox. The only way I can get it is by seeing you practice it and then attempting, however awkwardly I attempt to do that, to practice it in my own life. And I was reading today where it says that most of us consider it a force feeding of humility. You know, and then eventually I may get to a place where I actually want it. I want to just say one last thing about sponsorship, and I'll try and do this without being too soupy or too soppy. Because if you're new here, you may be wondering, well, how did an idiot like you, how did a person as arrogant as you are, as self-sufficient as you are, as self-reliant as you are, as defiant as you are, who was sponsoring himself for a good bit of time, how did you make that leap? How did you step from bridge to shore? How did you surrender to a sponsor? How did you find that relationship of value? And I'll just tell you that that relationship is so valuable to me that I know I wouldn't have the sponsor I have today, the home group I have today, or anything, the life that I have today. I'm going to say something that may sound a little treasonous to you, but my relationship with my sponsor is more important to me than my relationship with God. And that is because an alcoholic of my type will not have a relationship with God unless I listen to my sponsor first. Because I don't have access to God's website, but I do know how to get my sponsor. And if I get hooked up with my sponsor, I will acquire just enough humility to get back on my knees and say, help in the morning and thanks at night. And to remember that what I'm doing right now ain't going to keep me sober tomorrow. It ain't. This is a privilege, but there's no part of our book called Into Speaking. There is a part called Working with Others, and that seems to be where the juice is, right? But anyway, the leap. I got to a place at 13 years of physical sobriety where, you know, I mean, it was over one more time, and I met this guy named Glenn L. And so we started trudging the road together, and he agreed to take my case. And within a month, he was deathly ill and in the hospital. I don't know if one thing was connected to the other, but there you have it, you know. He had double pneumonia, and I mean, he had emphysema and 17% of his lung capacity going into the hospital, so we were certain that he was going to die. He wasn't coming out. But he did. And we were amazed, and we thought, you know, skilled nursing, whatever, long-term care. Nope, he gets back to his apartment, and the babies were remarkable. They formed a bucket brigade, and I had never seen this before because, see, I'm back over here on page 62, right? And we're cooking and we're cleaning and we're running errands and we're filling prescriptions and bringing food and just doing the deal, as my friend Sharon says. And one day it was my turn, my privilege to bring lunch. And there was always a bunch of guys over there at lunch, you know, just guys would get off work during the day and go over and see how their sponsor was, how Glenn was. He sponsored about 30 guys. And but for some strange reason that day, there was nobody else there but him. He was, I thought anyway, he was asleep on the couch. So I get there and I think, well, I'll put out some juice, I'll put out some soup or something, or just sit there. Maybe he needs to take a pill or something. Maybe I can help him out or whatever. I don't know what I was thinking, but I just think I'll just see what happens. I'll just sit here and quietly. And he rouses himself from this sleep, you know, that I think he's just completely out for the day. And he's in a great deal of pain, and he takes forever to sit up. He doesn't want my help. You know how we are. We can be dying. He still doesn't want my help. But anyway, so he sits up. And just out of left field, man, just like a thunderbolt, he says, Steve, He says, I want you to understand something. He says, I want you to know. I want you to know that Alcoholics Anonymous will never fail me. And he repeats it, kind of like Feed My Little Sheep. He says, I want you to understand that AA will never let me down. Now, if you set aside just for a moment the enormity of that message, set aside the fact that I was there to be of service to him, he was of service to me. Here's what his actions said to me at that moment. Because you can tell me anything you want, and I'm going to diss it, because I'm just about the smartest guy in AA. But your actions are irrefutable. What his actions said is, pay attention, kid, because your life may depend upon this. What I want you to get, Steve, what I want you to fully comprehend here is this. I'm showing you that there is never a time when it is too uncomfortable, too painful, or inconvenient to carry the message of AA. He saved my life that day. See, he knew I was still a sober horse thief. He knew I hadn't crossed Johnny's line. He knew I was still a taker and I hadn't crossed the line to becoming a giver. And that means I'm going to die drunk. I'm convinced of that. If I don't cross the line from being a taker to being a giver, I'm going to die drunk. Our book says it in many, many different ways. And he knew I didn't know that. And he did nothing short of making the book come to life before my very eyes. I didn't really understand what I was seeing. What he made come to life in front of me was that part in the book where it says, as ex-problem drinkers, our very lives depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. I didn't understand that then. I have a little better idea now. Thanks for letting me share.